It's Friday, September 9th, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today, we're continuing our month of digital photography with a focus on digital asset management.
Geek Speaks podcast and website are brought to you by GNI, a full-featured web hosting facility that provides co-location services and high-bandwidth connectivity. More information about GNI is available at www.gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Continuing the Digital Photography Month on Geek Speak, Peter Krogh joins the geeks with a discussion about his soon-to-be-released The Damn Book, Digital Asset Management for Photographers from O'Reilly. You can take pictures with your right index finger, but what do you do then? The entire rest of the process is considered digital asset management, and today we're talking all about it. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Sean Cleveland, Senior PR Marketing Manager for NetCell, Miles Elam, Technical Trainer for Surf Control, and Drew Meyer, Storage Specialist at AdaptTech, and our newly discovered geek, Josh Weiss, a personal geek ready for rent or lease. Give us a jingle at geekspeak.org, and of course, you can get in touch with Josh if you need help in the greater Monterey Bay Area. Even into San Jose, if he's desperate enough. Okay, geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Howdy.
What a plug, huh?
For lease or purchase?
That always strikes
unseemly
me as
unseemly somehow.
And Lyle, what do you do again?
Oh, yeah. I am the technical coordinator for the Digital Arts and New Media MFA program at UCSC.
That would be purchased then, right?
I've been purchased by the University of California.
And you get to play. You get to play with cool toys.
Man, cool toys. The job is great. I get to meet up with people that have already finished their undergraduate work, and now they're working on trying to find new ways of exploring art through technology. So the problem with it, the job actually, is having to understand every aspect of technology enough to support what artists might want to do. And it's all over the gambit, but it's a blast. But not nearly as a blast as you, Sean, who've been gone for a while because you had a new kid. How's that treating you?
Last night was actually pretty good. We got some sleep.
It's only been 2.5 weeks.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, 3 weeks later, you know. But it's great.
It's good to have you here.
It's pretty cool when I get home at night. I say hey to her, and she just brightens up and looks my way.
Are you back at work?
Oh, yeah, yeah. This week I went back to work.
All right. Well, before we get into our discussion with Peter Krogh about digital asset management, let's do some geek news. And I think I'll go ahead and start with Josh. Hey.
Do I have a mic on here?
You do have a mic on here.
Okay. The BBC opened up its archives as sort of their version of a Creative Commons thing. They're putting their archives available for download. And they're calling their Creative Commons a Creative Archive License. And this is going to be available to all British citizens for download to sort of be used creatively in the same way that you can get photos from Flickr or music under the Creative Commons license. So this is sort of a new opening of content and media from such a large organization as the BBC. I thought that was kind of cool.
I bet their archives are extensive, too.
They're huge.
Are they like, reverse releasing their archives, or are they just starting now to release all their content?
For now, they're just starting like this, but I think they're going to reverse release. I think they're interested in making their entire archives available.
Of course, their archives are so old that a lot of it's going to be analog. They're going to have to encode it and such.
Yeah, news archives have been doing this for a while. People have been doing research by going into the basements of newspapers and the like for many, many years. So this is really making that information available online the difference.
Well, it's still a big difference, though. I mean, also, when dealing with media like the BBC, where a lot of their content is radio and television content, going to their archives to get copies is so difficult. It's not like going in and bringing your pad of paper and a Xerox machine it's quite complicated. Kind of like the Library of Congress, where you have to get almost a grant to be able to get content from it. So it's nice to see that they're trying to make it a little easier.
Yeah.
Thank you, Josh, for that story. Indeed. Miles, since you've spoke up and we recognize your voice now, what's up?
Well, people have been wondering about how to deal with hydrogen in terms of storage, like the whole hydrogen economy.
As power source or power distribution network. Uh-huh.
For example, how do you get hydrogen contained in a tank in such a way that it's not going to be a huge safety hazard? In other words, it has to be under high pressure
in
order to contain a whole bunch of hydrogen in a small space. However, that means that you have a high probability of explosion in that case, and hydrogen will break down metallic containers.
That's not good.
Right. It will degrade them over time. Hydrogen actually degrades most things over time.
So probably a plastic container would be the solution to that, or glass.
Well, hydrogen is highly reactive with
ceramic
with items. So what a company called Aminex has done is they have bound the hydrogen chemically in a pill form or a disc form.
Uh-huh.
And what they found, actually, is that this storage material holds more than 9% hydrogen per volume of weight.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's pretty
good. Is actually higher than basically the Department of Energy had a threshold for how much hydrogen needed to be
available.
Available per unit, per a liter or volume of space.
And this thing beats it?
And this thing beats it.
So it's a solid form of hydrogen. Basically, something has reacted to hydrogen that's made it a solid. Thank you. But what is that material? Because once you use the hydrogen, you're going to have that material left over. Is it bad stuff?
Well, it is proprietary.
Ah, I see.
So I can't tell you exactly
what it is. It's arsenic.
However,
darn.
It has been found, at least in the concept level, for between 100 grams and 1 kilogram in size. So it's not production quality size, but it's still nice for prototypes. And it is safe to handle, simple and safe to handle in the open atmosphere.
Even without hydrogen bound to it? Or is that because
it
bounds hydrogen?
No, with hydrogen in it. And you can extract the hydrogen from it apparently very easily.
Uh-huh.
Don't know exactly how. But
I mean, of course, you've got water is a pretty good storage medium for hydrogen. It's 2-to-1 ratio on weight.
Except for the fact that to get the hydrogen out and separate it from the oxygen requires
a lot of energy.
Yeah, a fair amount of energy.
So this stuff basically
coal burning electricity.
Yeah. So this new chemical, whatever it might be, has it gone through EPA testing and stuff? Is this stuff safe enough from
this is early stages.
Early stages.
Well,
it sounds like
at the same time it's
solution.
Potentially a CO2 free hydrogen system.
Yeah, it sounds
unlike a methanol or carbon based hydrogen carrier.
Like it sounds wonderful. It sounds like a great solution. I mean, basically hydrogen is very reactive. Let's react it with something that we can break it apart later with.
Yeah. Makes although sense. There's no information yet on how much power is required to make this material to actually chemically bond it in the first place.
You need coal. No.
Okay. Yeah, who knows?
Well, of course that is the problem with hydrogen. It's not a source of energy. It's a
It's like a battery.
It's like a battery.
Just,
all right. Yeah. Thank you, Miles. You said you had one news story, but you didn't tell me it was such a great one. I'm going to go off to Sean, and we'll follow that up with Drew. What's up, Sean?
Yesterday, the Firefox 1.5 beta was released.
Was it yesterday? Because I downloaded it yesterday. I didn't know it was actually
It's codenamed Deer Park. The second beta should be released on October 5th, and they're hoping to have a released candidate by October 28th. This new version has new enhancements like better software update system, the ability to reorder tabs through drag and drop functionality, and improved pop-up blocking. It's supposed to work better with Mac OS 10. And early alpha versions, there's a snapback technology that allows for faster navigation through web pages.
Nice.
Well, I haven't played with that, so I'm not quite sure how that
works. In addition to that, it also supports SVG. And
which is a new image format that's vector-based.
Yeah, Miles, why is that so cool?
Because instead of having an image that's, for example, 300 pixels wide or one-third of the screen.
It looks different if you set the size wrong, right?
Right. If you've ever seen images that look like really blocky and fuzzy at large sizes, you'll understand what happens with what's known as a raster format. In other words, each pixel refers to a single color.
And opposite from that, SVG, if I...
And vector graphics, on the other hand, are done with lines, saying a line from here to here.
And make it curved this much.
Here to here.
I guess
so no matter how big you make it, a circle is a circle. A square is a square.
Right, and time is time, and we're running out, so I want to get to...
Actually, if you look at a newspaper, a picture of a newspaper, if you hold it away from your eyes, it looks pretty good. But the closer you get, it looks pretty bad.
Right.
Imagine if the closer you got, the sharper it got.
Nice.
That's what it would be like.
But one last thing, though.
Okay, one last thing.
One will interest you as well, Lyle. It also adds in multi-column support, being able to specify through CSS a newspaper-style
column. Okay, that's very exciting. Speaking of newspapers, that's very exciting. Thank you. We're going to have to do a whole show on Firefox, I think. Drew?
Let's see.
The last news story is you, man. What's up?
This is, I think this is pretty cool. Scientists in the UK have developed an ultralight limb that can mimic the movement of a real hand better than anything that's currently available. So it has an opposable thumb, it has four fingers.
How is it controlled?
It has six motors. It's all mounted at the wrist. It has a microprocessor that connects to the muscular skeletal structure. And it's lighter than a regular human hand.
We should just chop our hands off and replace them.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's pretty hard to do this. Now, the big deal is that they have an opposable thumb and four fingers. Most of the time, it's really hard. The real hand has 27 bones. It can make a huge number of complex movements and actions. It's hard to duplicate with mechanics. But they've done it, the best one so far. And apparently in the UK, about 200 people a year lose their hand. So this is a pretty useful thing.
Hmm. All right. Thank you very much, Drew.
It's controlled by the muscles?
The muscles interlink with a processor somehow, and I don't know exactly how that works. But that translates into mechanical action from the motors on the flexible fingers.
Well, at least theoretically, the human nervous system runs on electricity, electrical impulses. So
right.
The interface has been quite complicated, but it's true that for limbs like that, it's been one of the difficulties has been weight, that you just can't get so light. So
I don't.
Really
it must have to have power attached to it for the motors too. I don't know how that works.
Probably a hip pack of some kind, but we'll have to look into that because it's kind of cool technology. All right, thank you very much, Drew, and actually thank all the geeks this morning. Let's start over. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning: Miles Elam, Sean Cleland, Josh Weiss, and that was Drew Meyer. And I thank you all for participating on news. I'd like you to stay with us as we go into our topic at hand, which is a continuation of our entire month of digital photography. Today we're talking about digital asset management. We have the author of the new DAM book, Digital Asset Management for Photographers, which is out in November, from O'Reilly, Peter Krog. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, it's great to be a geek.
So Peter, once you take a picture with a camera, you got it captured on the camera. After that is digital asset management. What does it entail?
Well, I think the first thing you got to do is back up a little bit.
Okay.
And we want to look at the big picture. What we want to look at is our collection of photographs as a whole. And rather than looking at each individual picture, we want to think about the fact that over our lives we're going to collect thousands and thousands of photographs. And I'm speaking as both a professional, and I have a high economic interest in this, and an avid amateur, where I have a high personal interest. And so what we really want to do is think about how we view and manage, archive, save, and migrate these files, hopefully throughout our entire lives, so we always have access to them.
It's not your Converse shoebox anymore.
No, it is. It's the digital shoebox, and it's a lot more expensive.
So, and of course, the issue with this has increased rapidly by the amount of photographs people are taking with digital cameras, where you're not considering the whole process time. It's free to you, if you will, to take photographs once you have your camera. So it's this new growth in photography taking has led to some serious problems in handling your library, if you will. Everybody has to become a librarian.
Well, that's true, and the tools have been lagging behind, and I think probably the awareness of the need for the tools and the need for the practices has probably lagged behind as well. But it's hitting people like a ton of bricks right now.
Now, Apple's pretty smart about it. I mean, they built into their operating system they currently have. They built in this thing iPhoto, which handles a lot of needs for like a personal level. I don't know how large their library can handle at this point, but it seems like they're doing pretty well. What's your take from a professional perspective on something like iPhoto from Apple?
Well, from a professional perspective, it's pretty easy to just say it's not going to work. It's not robust enough, and it's
not going to work for a professional solution.
For a professional.
Do you think it works for a personal solution?
Well, you know, I personally don't think so. And the problem is it's not transparent enough. And you don't know what it's doing to your pictures, and you don't really have any control over it. And, you know, as I say, I like to think about this as a body of work, you know, a living thing. And I don't want it to be chopping it up and stuffing it over into other places. And I really want to see them. If my hard drive dies, I want to know where all these pictures were. I want to know that I backed them up, and I want to know that I can restore them.
Yeah, I get where you're coming from. I think I'm coming from the same place. It's this this idea that you've taken a file from the camera. You really want to keep that one file. You want to add meta information like who's in the picture or what wedding it was. You also want to make sure that you have that original file, if you will, for all time. And then that file's not easy to share in different ways. It's not easy to print. It's not easy to share online or email to people. So you want to translate that into other files, but you want to keep the original. So this kind of each file kind of grows into multiple files. That's a problem.
That's a huge problem, right?
Yeah. And then, of course, if you're working on the solution from Adobe currently, the kind of consumer line thing that's kind of equivalent to iPhoto on the Windows environment is Photoshop Elements 3, and it has an album management system in the Windows version only, which came from a Photoshop Album 2. And, for example, I started using that for 20,000 photos. But it's problematic because it's not standards-based, so it's not easy to translate that meta information off with the files. You kind of get stuck in this world of this application.
Yeah, I call that the prenup. And you got to have a way to go out, to get out if the relationship goes south. And exactly your point, metadata is the way to get out. You know, if you've spent hundreds or thousands of hours organizing files, you know, these are the great pictures of Josie and these are the great pictures of Maddie, you want to be able to push that data back into the files if you want to change applications. And most of the applications out there, and certainly any that I would recommend anybody consider, is going to be able to read metadata out of the file. So if you've put the keyword Josie into the file, then you should be able to change applications and have it re-index your entire library and find those pictures.
But, of course, that is assuming that the information gets stored to the file and not held in the applications. That's one of the things you're looking for.
Well, there's a big issue there, sure.
Okay. So let's say, at this point, I'd almost recommend people not to go with iPhoto because their library is going to grow at a rate that might surpass what Apple considers useful, but maybe not. I mean, what's your take on that perspective? Do you think that the home user, the majority of the people listening right now, need something more advanced than Elements or iPhoto?
You know, I think that I'd probably look more at Elements than iPhoto, just because I'm really bothered by the fact that you can't see what it's doing to your pictures.
Yeah.
And when you make a change, you don't really have the control over, am I changing the picture or am I making a new copy?
Mm-hmm.
And I think Elements is probably a pretty good choice, but I haven't really investigated the amateur market as thoroughly as I've been working on the professional market.
Right.
And I would love to be able to tell you I know exactly what the right one is for my dad who's got a little, you know, Canon point and shoot and an Emac. But
it's interesting because my recommendation for parents and grandparents and the like is to make sure you save copies of everything. You know, don't make CDs and all this. But then, of course, you're going to run into this massive problem that it used to be that if you found the negatives in a shoebox, you were, like, done. You found the source. You're, like, set. But when you have multiple CDs and there's copies of photos and then they were cropped differently and there's no naming system, what a mess at any point to try to figure that out. And
well,
as it grows, it becomes more and more of a problem.
There's a couple of things that anybody should do, whether you're a professional or amateur, and one of those is that you should always give your photographs a unique name.
Mm-hmm.
Each one should have its own unique name.
What's your feeling on naming structure? What do you do?
I put my name at the beginning because I want my clients to know it came from me.
Because you're egotistical. No, sorry.
And, well, you know, I got an economic interest in these pictures.
Of course.
And then I use a six-digit date, European-style date with, you know, year, month, day. And that's what is the real guarantor that I have a unique file name.
Well, but
because
you
I can
take
only,
more than
you know,
one.
If I shoot more than 10,000 pictures in a day, then I'm going to have to...
So you do a six-digit year, and then you do an index number of that day.
Yes, and typically that would pick up the original unique identifier number, that four-digit number
from the camera.
That the camera wrote, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't have my camera reset every time you put a card in. Most
right.
cameras, you can choose it to...
You keep it going.
And you keep it going. And that way, you're going to have, you know, many fewer images with a unique identifier of, you know, 4387
right, right.
than you would a unique identifier of 0011.
Right.
It now, becomes a much more helpful searching tool.
I have the same dilemma and concern, and the way I name my files, I don't put my name on it, which is a good, I think it's probably a good idea to put your name on it.
Initials are probably, I mean, my name's reasonably uncommon and short. If it's,
yeah.
you know, if your name is Schwarzenegger,
yeah,
you're probably going to run into some file length problems.
Right. So, I do that the same thing with the European date, which basically is a four-digit year, a two-digit month, and a two-digit day. I put hyphens in it so it's easier to read. But basically, that format really ensures that, you know, anytime someone asks me for a file, and if I put them online and share them and stuff, if somebody asks me for a print, they can give me a really good starting base of where it is. And then I do have a number, which normally is just an index number per month because that's unique enough for me.
Yeah.
And I rename all of them, and I don't keep the original file name from the camera. And that's because...
Yeah, I believe they should be renamed.
Yeah.
Essentially the first thing that you do.
That's what I do, exactly.
And you know, there's another issue about having unique file names, and it's not just, can I find it when somebody asks me for it? I think that everybody ought to be looking down the road and expecting that at some time in the future, the media that they're storing their photographs on is going to fail. You're going to have a hard drive failure.
It's just a matter of time.
And, you know, you're going to have a DVD or a CD that's going to get scratched, and by having unique file names, it makes it much easier to reconstruct an archive, so that you know that you've got everything, and you know, geez, which DSC 1234 is this? You
yeah,
know,
basically,
this?
It's impossible to manage unless you have unique file names. It
yeah,
really is.
So we can take that as a given.
I have a question. Does anybody know why the default name on those photos from the camera manufacturers is so poorly done? In my opinion.
Or why is it always DSCs?
You know, I've been asking the same question, and I think that there's some kind of, there is some compatibility issue where they just can't get above 8 characters to be absolutely, totally, universally compatible.
So they want to still sync to a DOS machine, and therefore they got to keep 8 characters as their max file name.
I'm a Mac guy, but that may well be
why DSC? That's one I've seen the most often.
AUG is another one, I think. There's a lot of them, but...
I got no idea.
That's a good question. We'll try to find out.
So
we need the camera guy to come on the show.
Okay, so first thing you do in this digital asset management is make a unique file name. What do you normally use to do that?
I'm using Bridge, and I guess that...
Adobe Photoshop CS Bridge.
Yeah, let me back up a little bit and say that for the purposes of this part of the discussion, maybe we should be talking to, or state that... That we're talking about people with DSLRs like a D70 or Canon Rebel and above.
So
or do we want to be
cameras where you have raw files as your source.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, because that really presents a whole set of other problems that I think are really the true challenges. And more than that, those there are some solutions now that are really wonderful, great solutions that wrap this whole thing up. But that having been said, yes, when I shoot pictures, I bring them into Adobe Bridge, which is the new file browser in Adobe Photoshop CS2. And it lets me do a bunch of things to the file. I rename them. And I also add metadata right there. They have a template that you can add. You can sort of pre-fill out it's kind of like a little notepad.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a place for lots of different kinds of information that's in every kind of graphic image file. And some of it is information that the camera writes, which is called EXIF data, and that's stuff like the date, the shutter speed, the name of the camera. And then there's a place for what's called IPTC, and this is stuff that was originally created for newspapers where, you know, they were sending electronic files in the 70s. And that's been beefed up now in CS2, and it has room for just all kinds of stuff, like the phone number of the photographer, the street address of the photographer, the website of the photographer, and a ton of information about the image file itself, where it was shot, who's in it, what keywords might be associated with it. And Yeah.
Let's keep on going with this topic. I got to take a quick break. I want to invite everyone who's listening, please don't be shy to ask us questions a lot simpler than what we're talking about. We're talking about kind of pros and high-end amateur photographers and the issues they run into. And we're welcoming any calls about photography. In fact, we'll take calls about any technical problems you might have. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. If you are interested in joining our conversation with technical questions, especially about photography questions, the phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the internet. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us to send us email. Support for this program comes from Metro Santa Cruz newspaper, including a complete calendar, club grid, and dining section, arts writing, and criticism. Metro Santa Cruz is available in Santa Cruz County every Wednesday.
This week in This American Life, we have surprising stories from New Orleans survivors as they head out in their diaspora across the country. And insiders at FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, tell the story of how their agency changed over the last 4 years and how its ability to respond to natural disasters and other emergencies has been dismantled. That's this week on This American Life from Public Radio International.
Catch This American Life Sunday at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
The 21st Annual California Coastal Cleanup Day is September 17th, sponsored by the California Coastal Commission in cooperation with California nonprofit groups, cities, and counties. Coastal Cleanup Day happens at beaches, creeks, lakes, and shorelines throughout the state. To get involved, call the California Coastal Commission at 800-COAST-4U.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Trox. The geeks in the room today, that was Drew Meyer, Miles Elam, Josh Weiss, and Sean Cleveland. And we're speaking with author and photographer Peter Krogh about digital photography, specifically how to manage all the data that you have. We're continuing the entire month of digital photography. Later on this month, we're going to be having somebody on from iView Media Pro, which, Craig, if I'm not mistaken, I'm sorry, Peter, if I'm not mistaken, is the application you use for the later process after of managing and archiving your collection. Is that true?
Yeah, it's a great program. I found it to be very intuitive and really, really powerful in the way that it lets you split up your image files and tag them with the information you want them to have.
Now, what if I'm just a home user and I don't have Adobe CS or I don't have the budget for Adobe CS?
Well, then I would take a look at Elements. I'm pretty sure you can get a free trial download. I'm not positive about that, but
you can get a 30-day free trial. Now, the other solution might be to go with something like Google's Pix. Oh, now I can't recall the name of it.
Picasso. It's called Picasso,
which does do some management.
Yeah.
Will it sort and rename? Like, that's the biggest thing. You've got this huge list of unnamed files, and you don't want to edit everyone by hand, right?
Let's take a call from Drew on Highway 17, who I think is going to ask a very similar question. So, Drew, are you going to mirror our Drew on your question?
Yeah, that was exactly my question. I mean, if I got a bunch of these photos already, what I do is simply, and I'm very much an amateur, I just use XP and, you know, make my own files, call that file, whatever that group of photos I want to call, and then keep the actual 001, 02, whatever.
You mean
I want
a folder.
To go back and rename all those. You know, so
yeah.
Is there a quicker way to, I mean, do I have to? And if so, what's the quickest way to do that besides manually?
You need to be looking for a batch rename function. And almost all of the applications will let you do a batch rename.
Applications
that should be
like
no more than just, a few seconds of work, and then the thing will chug away and do its job.
You mean in an application like an Adobe product, though?
Well, iView does it beautifully.
Okay.
I can't imagine that Picasa doesn't, but I haven't looked at it for a while. The last time I looked at it, there were a couple of things that I consider to be kind of deal killers.
Now, Drew on Highway 17, I hope you're not driving right now, but I want to just say that my problem when naming files, I really want a specific file name. I looked around for free apps, and before Bridge, it didn't have really a naming scheme that I liked. So I looked around quite a bit, and I finally wrote an application to solve this need. It was just a quick, simple Perl script, but it solved the problem.
Oh,
so
yeah, most
I
of
see,
our listeners.
But what I'm saying
that.
Is I see the dilemma there. That's not a good solution for most people, is to write an application for this. But, yeah, I'm...
there's a lot
especially
of
when you have tools. People like writing these Perl scripts and they keep calling certain geeks late at night saying, wait, how do I do this? What's going on with this?
I've never asked you for a Perl question.
That's a fallback position, yeah.
Drew, on Highway 17, I just want to say that there are free naming applications. We are not talking about naming the files manually. That would be crazy. There are a lot of them out there.
Hey, so, can I, how do you search for those? Just like batch naming? Is that what they're kind of look? That's what you look under?
Peter, what do you think?
Yeah, you should poke around in it. Almost all applications that are worth using are going to have a good batch renaming feature. So okay, batch cool. rename is, and they may hide it under something else, but it's
but
such
that's
a simple
category
basic.
Name. Batch renaming is kind of that's the concept.
Yes.
Great. Okay, cool.
Thank you very much. We're gonna say goodbye to you now, Drew.
Yeah, cool. Bye.
I think this Picasa looks like a good choice. I just jumped on the web and looked at it. It's a Google product. It does what we're talking about.
Does it do renaming?
Yeah, instantly find, edit, and share. And I think the editing...
I mean, I'm not sure if you can rename. I know you can do...
I take it back.
Yeah, let me bring in a little kind of geeky distinction there, which is that there's a lot of these applications are what are really called browsers, which means you point them at a folder full of images, and they tell you what's there. Really helpful, nice, important thing to have. But that's very different than a cataloging application. Because what a cataloging application does is it kind of harvests all that information and keeps it in a catalog, a database document. So it knows what's supposed to be there. And it really helps in a couple of ways. One is it really helps you to manage your photographs. And the other, it really helps you in the event that you have some kind of a problem, because if you have a hard drive failure, then you want to go to your catalog, hopefully you've backed it up, and you look at it and say, okay, what are all the files I'm supposed to be looking for? Mm-hmm. A browser will just say, oh, there's no pictures there. And if one of the central challenges here is how do we keep these pictures for 20 or 30 years, then I think a cataloging application is absolutely indispensable.
All right, let's go on to Tom in Watsonville. Welcome to GeekSpeak. Tom?
Yeah, I have a Macintosh, and I've had recommended to me for this purpose a program called iView. I heard you mention it a few times there just a minute or two ago, but do you have any experience with this program, or is there anything else for the Mac?
It's the best.
Thank you, Tom, for the call.
It's the best out there, and it's $200
Ouch.
For the real version, so it's kind of expensive. You know, compare that to maybe buying and processing 20 rolls of film, so it's not, or 10 rolls of film, so it's not like it's incredibly expensive, but it's going to take a bite. You know, a lot of people won't buy it because of that, but it really, really works well. It's very intuitive and just a tremendous application.
We're working on having people from iView on later on this month to talk about.
And there's two things, also something else. There's two products. There's iView Media Pro and iView Media.
And what's the difference?
The Pro is a better application. If a couple of features would migrate down to the Media version, then I think it would be a really great application to.
Is the Media version cheaper?
Yeah, I think it's like $40 or $50.
Yeah, so possibly that's the solution. We'll have a good look at that later when we have them on the show. I want to say that, I totally agree with you on this asset management thing rather than just browsing. So basically your book, and this is going to be, a little frustrating for some listeners, is really aimed at these people that are doing raw files. And therefore kind of higher end cameras like myself, but possibly not a lot of people. But it's the same kind of issues that come up in anything you're doing in digital photography and digital asset management.
Yeah, can I
please
chime in here with something? I think one of the most important issues to think about is where the heck do you put these things? You know, what's the media that you're using? And what I say to almost everybody who asks me this is that, A, you need two copies of everything. You really need at least one backup of everything. And B, I really believe that you should have a dedicated storage space. So I would suggest not having it go, Apple wants to put it in the pictures folder and Windows wants to put it
My pictures. Silly.
And what I would suggest is that you go buy a FireWire hard drive or USB 2 hard drive, put it on your computer, and that's the place your pictures live. and that you mirror that onto another one. So that, you know, maybe they're $100 a piece, but this, but you know, $100 worth of hard drive will hold in JPEGs hundreds of thousands of pictures, and that's just really, really a good deal. And anybody who's had a hard drive crash knows that it's just, you know, a horrible, sickening feeling. And
those
I would,
of you that have not have a hard drive crash will, unless you're not using a computer.
There's two kinds of people, people who've had it and people who will. And you know, what I suggest to my, you know, friends and family is put the second one at a different location. Computer equipment gets stolen a lot. You know, voltage surge, virus can toast it really quickly. And, you know, that's probably the most important thing you have on your computer.
Your photographs.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can redo your financial records. You can, I mean, there's everything else that's on
your
computer you can redo.
Well, I actually believe that you should mirror the whole thing and take it off-site, too. But
well, there's also people that write. I mean, if you've got a writing collection on a computer, I have a friend who has a whole bunch of writing stuff on old hardware that you can't get the data off of, and how frustrating is that?
Well, and that's where this, you know, this whole media management thing is really exploding, because our whole lives are online right now.
Yeah.
And...
Well, and storage is cheap. It's way cheaper than the pain of reconstructing that stuff.
Absolutely. I had while I was writing this book, the drive in my PowerBook died. I got up, I came back, sat back down, it was gone.
Oof.
And, you know, I had a one-day-old backup that had the entire, everything mirrored, you know, all my email, all my web bookmarks, everything, and it was less than one day to be back where I was before.
Nice.
So if you're a consumer user, I think that USB and FireWire is probably a good idea. Do you have a thought about maybe DVD drives?
Well, I use DVDs as well, and let me see if I can explain this over the phone. I have developed what I call the bucket system. And basically what I do is when I come back from a shoot, I just start putting images into a folder until the folder hits 4 gigs, roughly, about the size of a DVD. Then I start a new folder, and then I burn those to DVD.
And your archiving solution considers those folders to be part of the file name? It knows about those folders?
That's the beautiful thing. Well, that's the important thing, is that you want to develop an information structure that's permanent. So, yes, you want to keep them, you want to put them in a place, and you just keep them there. You don't want to be moving stuff around. And so all my original files get just dropped into these buckets. And I'm at, you know, bucket 220 or something like that.
That means you have 220 DVDs.
I do.
Now, DVDs can fail, so that's not your only solution?
No, my primary is the hard drive that's connected to my imaging workstation.
Man, what a mess.
Or it's a whole set of hard drives.
I mean, it's a lot.
It's a JBOD.
This is a lot of work. This is a lot of understanding about. This is like, you got to be really involved in your collection.
Well, for most people, it would be, you know, one 512 media card equals about one CD.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, dump the media card onto your hard drive, call it, you know, media card 001, burn that to a CD, and then next time you download your media card, you put it in a folder called media card 002, and then, you know, burn that to a CD.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam, Drew Meyer, and Josh Weiss, and we are talking about digital asset management with author and photographer Peter Krogh. You're welcome to join the conversation. It doesn't have to be about photography. We'll take anything. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can send us email. We are checking email, right, geeks? Geekspeak.org. Click on Contact Us. In fact, we have something. So, Sean, please go ahead and address this question from Lee.
So Lee says Picasa does support battery naming. XF data
is the meta information that comes from the camera. Uh-huh.
Correct. Never alters the originals and effectively has transparent versioning and document management. He says he used to use iView Multimedia, but finds that Picasa is better. The only thing it really doesn't do is layers and masks, but that's when you right-click to open in Photoshop, and it has no ICC profiles. It is free.
It is free, and we want to make sure that Lee is actually emailing from Amsterdam. I'm assuming he's listening on air, unless he has a really good radio. and that's really an important thing. One other thing that he mentioned is XF data, and it manages that. It doesn't deal with RAW files. So Picasa is a great solution for people that are shooting JPEGs. I highly recommend taking a look at it, especially since it's free. It's wonderful. Unfortunately, it doesn't help the pros that or prosumers like
myself. Most pros and prosumers who have high-end digital video cameras can afford the tools they need.
Yeah, they will. So we're taking calls, and we have lots of them online, so we're just going to go ahead and start taking those. Dean, in your car, welcome to Geeksby. I hope you're not driving, Dean.
I pulled over.
Thank you very much. What's your question?
I had a question, and I can take the answer off the air. I'm thinking about upgrading my digital camera, and you know, the Rebel sounded really good because of you say it does the raw picture taking. I was wondering, once you do the storage, can you do online printing? Is it a difficult because of the higher megapixels of transferring online to get your printing done, like over your DSL connection, or is it better just to put it on a disc and take it into your photo service and have it printed there?
Thank you for the question. We'll take it off air.
I would say that, first thing you need to know about when you shoot RAW is you're going to need to convert it to something else. So you're going to be working in some kind of software like Adobe Photoshop CS2, and you can bring those RAW files in and you can adjust them. But then if you want to take those to the lab, you'd use the image processor, which is part of Adobe Bridge, and it can automatically resize and spit out a whole batch of JPEGs at whatever size you want to print them, burn them on a CD or FTP them or email them to your lab. You know, you can definitely put them on a CD and take them down to Ritz and, you know, put the thing in and get a bunch of 4x6.
But they really have to be JPEGs at that point.
Yeah. RAW files really need to be converted to do almost anything with.
Except for store them.
That brings up a point. I suggest that all RAW files get converted to DNG and stored.
So you think that... So are you doing that?
I'm doing that.
Uh-huh.
And there's a couple of things that the DNG does.
Now, DNG is Adobe's open source, if you will, RAW file format.
Right. And, you know, the DNG is supposed to stand for digital negative. But I consider it more of a digital job jacket because it can store a whole lot more than just that RAW image data, the negative, if you will. It can also store paperwork in the form of metadata. You can write those keywords and stuff into the DNG, and it puts it in a place that every application can see. When you shoot a RAW file, every RAW file from, you know, RAW files from every different camera are slightly different. And the camera manufacturers are not nice enough to openly document where they keep that information.
Is there batch processing available?
For DNG?
For converting RAW to DNG?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You can do it within Bridge, within the new camera RAW, which is just an absolutely tremendous application. And there's also the free Adobe DNG converter. And it's a little applet, you know, a little thing you just drop a folder on, and out pops a whole bunch of DNGs.
And it's just a great way to go, I think. I also want to say very clearly that if you have a camera right now, and it does have a RAW setting, and you have Photoshop CS, or especially Photoshop CS2, I highly recommend playing with it because you will be you'll switch over automatically to RAW, I think. At least I did, and it's been a pain since because, of course, they're larger files. We're going to take a call from Monterey. Gilbert, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello?
Hello, Gilbert. You're on GeekSpeak.
Hi. I had a question. I was listening to you guys over the summer, and someone called in, and their web designer had... gone south, and they wanted to update their site, but they didn't want to get too heavy into Dreamweaver. And you guys had mentioned a free WYSIWYG web editor.
Gilbert, I really appreciate you calling in because I was trying to get Miles to answer this because he's the one that knew what it was, and his email response time has been bad lately. So, Miles,
I was in Kentucky.
What's the name of the application? I know you're in Kentucky.
Yeah.
Okay. I remember that too, and I was trying to think of it too.
We were all trying
to
answer.
Sparkle Fox or something cute.
Miles, you mean NVU?
NVU.
Oh, NVU. Okay, then.
So do a Google on NVU, HTML probably.
And those are the letters, not actually spelling out the words,
right,
but the letter N, the letter V, and the letter U.
Right.
And those are found in your alphabet near you.
Does it have SFTP protocol?
I
am sure it does.
I don't know if it has secure FTP.
We're talking about a really good WYSIWYG editor. We have had one complaint from someone that listened to the show, started using it, and found that it was quite buggy. But I'm assuming that will get
fixed.
Found
it on the Mac that it was buggy.
Buggy on the Mac. So if you're depending on where you are, you might run into some problems. But NVU is the name of the application. Google will find it, and we'll probably spit out the URL pretty soon once one of us looks it up.
It's NVU.com.
Imagine that, NVU.com.
Okay. Yeah, I'm searching
them. Well, let me ask you, I have just two more questions. One of them, it has to do with the interface between, if you guys have used the NVU WYSIWYG, the interface between that, say, and then Dreamweaver? Are they kind of swappable?
No.
Okay, so you can't pull the code from the NVU stuff into Dreamweaver and then
work on it. Yeah, they'll both see each other because they're both going to be underlying HTML.
Right.
But Dreamweaver's got some templates in there, and NVU will ignore those templates completely. So you're going to be able to edit and manage the file in a way that maybe the designer was not intending for you to do.
Yeah,
templates are basically restricted.
They're really two different products. NVU is, you have an idea in your head about what you want to make, and this is going to make it easier to do without making you write HTML or JavaScript. Dreamweaver is made more as an overall production production application.
Thank you, Gilbert, for the call. We're going to go on to the next person, okay?
Okay, no problem.
Thank you so much. We're going to go now to Santa Cruz. Eric, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I resisted for a long time before I got a digital camera, and I'm not afraid of technology. In fact, I used to work as a Unix systems programmer, and I have a BA in computer science. But I think this conversation is illustrating, you know, the whole problem behind it. If you have a regular film camera, you take a picture, you get it developed, and there it is, and there's no management headache at all.
And except for finding a shoebox.
Exactly, and in fact, that's where I have my pictures.
Yeah, and keeping it temperature and humidity control.
And not only that, you know, the image quality is much better for the, you know, for the comparable price camera. So unless you're doing high-end stuff, why even bother? I mean, you know, even if you get the batch renaming and whatnot, it still is a lot more work than just taking... and then to print, you know, if you want... it just seems like...
It's true. There's
unless you're, like, really into, like, you know, being a nerd with your camera, why bother?
Good question. Thank you, Eric, for the call.
Well, when you talk about the management, I think off the top of my head, there are a lot of photos that I've gone through with my family where we see the photo, and especially after a member of the family has died, you go and you find all these pictures, but there's no labeling on them. No one has written down a date. No one's written down the names of it. I mean, the same issues do come up, whether it's digital or analog, or whether it's, you know, standard photography. So to say, how do you manage this? You get all the meta information in there. It's still the case with standard photography.
Right.
To be able to go, wait, who is that?
And even worse, when you think about a shoebox full of, you know, 20 years worth of negatives, looking through that is, you know, if you labeled everything nicely, put them in notebooks and, you know, kept them temperature and humidity controlled for 20 years, then, you know, maybe they're just fine and it's real easy to find them, but...
It's not easy to find photos when you're talking about thousands of them. If they're
I have an entire room devoted to film. So
yeah, that's a good point. You are a traditional photographer. You're still using film.
I am not.
I haven't shot
a lick of film in like 2 years.
Wow. Okay.
And, I have this room of film that I'm going to have to, you know, have forever, which is, you know, that's big. Big issue.
Yeah, well, it looks like Google has once again just been amazing. Google's Picasa, which we just mentioned, actually does support RAW. Lee from Amsterdam, who's listening dedicatedly and is now our official long-distance geek, I think, sent in that says if you've got RAW images, Picasa will handle them. They'll handle them from Canon, Nikon, Olympus, Sony, Fuji, Pentax, Kodak, and the Canon 20D. Basically, Picasa is doing the RAW. It never modifies the files. It's just great and everything. And if you haven't played with it, you should. Or so Lee says from Amsterdam. Thank you, Lee, for emailing us.
Or if you can't afford Adobe CS2 or Bridge,
right? And it's expensive.
Yeah, it is.
But I do. You know, people don't get this, but it's hard to get it until you need it. But there really is a difference between a browser and a cataloging application.
Yes.
Something knows where things are supposed to be. Something just sees what's there.
That's right. And one of them has a database to store information about it, the cataloging system, and the other is just looking at the files that are there.
Right.
Yep, good point. All right, we do have a lot more calls and not very much time.
I do have the obligatory question,
please,
though. Is there something that Google doesn't do?
And for all our listeners, that's Picasa, PICASA.com.
Thank you very much. Gail from Pescadero, welcome to GeekSpeak. I'm sorry, Gail. Hello, welcome.
Hello?
Yes, you are on. What's up?
Oh, hi. I'm actually from the Pleistocene era.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Not Gilroy. I have a really simple question. When I try to go to Internet Explorer, it says runtime error. This application has requested the runtime to terminate it in an unusual way. And I click OK, and it just doesn't do anything. So I've been having to use Mozilla.
Good.
Which is fine, which works, but...
That's not pretty.
Why is IE crashing is your question?
Yeah.
And I've
reinstalled it.
You have?
Yeah.
And so you still get that same error?
Yep.
Oh. Yeah, that's not pretty. If Mozilla works, I would just quietly forget about Explorer.
No, you do. Explorer is a major part of the operating system, unfortunately.
And to do Windows updates, you need to have it.
You need to have it. So what you need to do is get your CDs and reinstall your operating system. That will be the best.
But wait a minute, guys. That's a huge deal, right?
Yeah,
you're going to lose your data. You're going to lose all your applications, all of your settings.
You know what? I got a great suggestion for you, Gail.
Okay.
You send an email to us, because you can do that through Mozilla. Just go to geekspeak.org. And Josh is available for hire.
No.
He'll come to your house at a fee and help you out. You can rent him, lease him, or buy him. That's up to you.
Lyle's got it's a genuine point. I mean, it's probably worth your time to pay Josh to do this instead of figure it out on your own.
Or someone.
Yeah.
But I pay in seeds and berries.
Well, he's hungry. You know.
He needs to eat. Yeah. Okay, thank you for the call. I'm sorry, I can't help you.
Good luck.
Okay, fine.
We have an in-studio question, Lyle?
Yes, go ahead.
We have someone wondering what are the best free photo listing sites if you want to put your photos online and show them to people, share them with people.
The cat's meow in the geek world is Flickr.com.
Yes.
FLICKR.com. It's got a great interface. It's got some cool tools for multiple operating systems to import your files. And it's just fun.
It's a great place to be a geek.
Yeah, and if you're interested in finding photos about anything in the world, go to Flickr.com. It's like a mass, and there's no E in the end of that. It's a mass sharing system, and you can look up a keyword and find photos of that. So if you're interested in finding photos from any area in the world, just put in the city name. You'll find people's photos. And it's fun. It's just a blast to use, and it's easy to share, and you get a lot of bandwidth, a lot of free up storage, and it's a great place to be, I think. Flickr.com is the one I recommend.
I've been searching a little bit on SFTP question with EnView, and I don't believe that it supports it, but you can use SFTP clients with it. So it's not native to the application, but you can use your other client for our listeners.
So in other words, save to the hard drive and then do the separate.
Yeah, move SFTP. It with a different tool.
I'm going to risk taking one more call from Santa Cruz. Jane, hi. We don't have a lot of time. What's your question? Jane?
Oh, hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I got static instead of that.
All right.
I have two questions quickly. I've been thinking about, I don't even have a digital camera. I've been using film for all my life. I've been looking at a digital point and shoot that has a RAW as one of its possibilities. I have two questions about that. One is, if you have to convert a RAW file into something else in order to print it, why do RAW? And the second question is, if a camera says it has a RAW file, are they all the same, or okay. Is there something more I should be looking for?
Thank you very much for the call. Peter, you want to address that?
Yeah. I would suggest you probably don't want something that shoots RAW right now. And I would say that what you want is something that, make sure it shoots some movies. That's what I love in my point and shoot. I have a little Sony that shoots movie files, and I have a little underwater housing for it, and it's just the coolest thing since sliced bread. And you know, cut your teeth, play around a little bit, see if you enjoy it. See if the computer stuff is, you know, fun and reasonable and something you want to do before you start shooting RAW files. And that said, anything that shoots RAW will almost always shoot a JPEG as well. But first camera, for someone who doesn't even know whether they want a digital camera, don't believe all the hype on RAW. RAW is a, you know, it's a tool for the kind of serious amateur or for the professional photographer.
For a geek. GeekSpeak is proudly sponsored by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Felton offering color printing, design, computer rentals, delivery office supplies, shipping via FedEx, UPS, DHL, and a lot more. Details at businesswithpleasure.com. Our guest today is Peter Krogh. Works with all formats of equipment, from digital photography to large format film cameras to complex location lighting assignments. Peter brings 20 years experience, a fresh approach, and a bold eye to his projects, or so Riley says about him. He owns and maintains digitalphotographystandards.com. Peter's new book, available in November, The Damn Book, Digital Asset Management for Photographers, from O'Reilly. Peter, thank you very much for joining us today on GeekSpeak.
Hey, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
The geeks this morning, Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam, Josh Weiss, Drew Meyer, and of course our guest. And answering the phones today was Michael Lewis. Thank you all for your participation in GeekSpeak.
And thank you for listening to GeekSpeak. To those who called in and emailed in, thank you for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, I'd just be us geeking out. And who wants to listen to that? GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. The program is supported by Cruise.io. Supported by Cruise.io as well as Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. I have said many times that if you are editing photographs on your computer, there is no substitute for Adobe Photoshop, but Photoshop is very complex. Next week on GeekSpeak, continuing our month-long topic of digital photography, we have the author of Adobe Photoshop CS2 One-on-One, which has an accompanying DVD that helps you out immensely. Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KVH San Otto, on the web at kusp.org. Thanks for listening.